Give the cop down there, eh?
Well, it's so good of you to meet with us this afternoon and tell us about your, give us a narration about your experience in relation to the grain trade and perhaps other things as well. Perhaps we can start by putting on the record things you've just told me in terms of your name, first of all.
Linda Luzak.
And your place and date of birth.
I was born in Port Arthur on June the 7th, 1952.
And then you might tell us how you came to work in the grain trade, unless that was some distance into your life and there might be some things we should get on the record before.
No, I went away to university, went to the University of Western Ontario and took a degree in chemistry. And I decided that I didn't want to live in Southern Ontario particularly, came home. But there weren't a lot of jobs up here for that sort of training, and especially not for women, outside of a hospital environment, and that really wasn't my area. So I had a few part-time jobs. At one point, I actually worked at the Canadian Grain Commission in the protein lab doing protein testing.
How long were you there?
Oh, just a few months. It was a seasonal position. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Ignace, got married, and fate had me come back to Thunder Bay when I secured a job at Industrial Grain Products.
And that would have been when?
In 1977. And at that point, Industrial Grain Products was one of the few places you could get a job and do some kind of lab work that wasn't hospital related. And I was one of the first two women hired there, which was, this is a big revolutionary thing that happened at the time.
And how did you experience the revolution? Or maybe it's other people who experienced
the
revolution.
The
You're the agent of revolution.
Well, yeah, it was a lot of change for the plant. It was full of men, and we worked around the clock. And but the lab was my domain, and I work in the quality assurance lab. So we tested out various samples from the processed and the finished goods to make sure that they met quality standards, and off we go. And at the time, I don't think that too many people, unless they had someone who was working there, and a lot of people did work at some point in their lives at Industrial Grain Products or the Ogilvie Mill, especially on this side of town.
Yes.
It wasn't uncommon when you looked at obituaries, worked at Ogilvie, worked at Ogilvie, worked at Industrial Grain Products. And we didn't actually start out with raw grain. Our raw material was flour.
Oh, yes.
Which of course, came from the west. From
the Ogilvie Mill in Winnipeg, I suppose.
Winnipeg and the one in Medicine Hat. And then occasionally we buy flour from someplace else, depending if the price was right. Those buying decisions weren't made in Thunder Bay. They were made in Montreal, because that's where the head office was.
At the company headquarters.
Right, right.
How long had the mill been here, do you know?
Well, I'd forgotten. I started looking things up and trying to find out. Ogilvie built a flour mill in 1904.
Yes, I thought it would be a long time ago as a flour mill, but the conversion.
And then it fell into the river in 1906.
Oh, yes.
And there's pictures, you know, around of the mill falling into the river. And then I'm not sure how long they were actually milling anything there, or whether it was just grain or what they were doing. But in 1943, they installed a starch and gluten processing facility. And that was first place in Canada. And we had a sister plant in Quebec. And right now, I think that is probably the only place in Canada where wheat gluten is produced. So
it would be presumably a wartime need. And I suppose the MP for Port Arthur, the Honorable C.D. Howe, may have played his part, a Minister of Munitions and Supply, in having the plant move to
that. I'm
not
sure.
No?
I think it was a way to use all the products from the flower stream.
Mm-hmm.
Because the flour that we used was not the same flour as goes into baking. A flour mill has, it's a work of art actually, a flour mill, and how the miller chooses to grind the wheat that to come up with the flour that he wants. And we used our flour had particularly high protein, and because the gluten was the most valuable part of this whole process.
Yes.
So I can't tell you why or how or but it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Here and that lasted till 1996, and then for a short time in 1998 and 99 when Riverside Grain Products tried to resurrect the operation.
Right. And you worked in the lab for how long? Through the whole earlier period?
No, well, I started in 1977, and then I became the quality assurance manager in 1985. I found the my little notice that I was
promotion letters.
Promotion time, and then I had an interest, and I suppose I had some ability, and I ended up covering for the production manager and covering for the manager when he was away, and then when we got, you may know the manager that I had for the longest time was Norman Holman. Have you heard of Norm Holman?
I don't think I have. He's still with us.
No, he died. He was pretty active with the meter eaters. After he retired, we had got a new manager, and then in 1993, after ADM bought mm-hmm. Ogilvy from Labatt's.
Archer Daniels Midland.
Yeah, bought Ogilvy from Labatt's in 1992, I think, and then decided to close us in 1993. At that point, we got a reprieve, and then it ended up closing in 1996. And at that point, our manager, who had already undergone two closures of plants in Southern Ontario, took a job out west, and ADM asked me to manage the plant. And in my mind, that wasn't really a good sign, because I wasn't the sort of person that they really needed to move the plant forward, but I could definitely look after it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we struggled on for another 3 years, and then the plant closed in 1996.
So you had this sort of terminal managership for 3 years. Well,
yeah.
That's enough time to learn some things about
it.
It
was pretty instructive.
Yeah.
the whole process.
Thank you very much for sketching that, and later we can come to that second attempt, or the attempt rather, to open it again as someone tried to get Shaw Bakeries reopened,
yeah.
Or bakery rather, and that failed as well. So let's focus on the lab for a time, or
sure.
You can sketch for us what kind of work was done in there and the part you played in the lab.
We ran quality control on the process itself and then on the finished products.
Could you sketch the production process for
us? Sure. If you imagine flour and water making a ball of dough,
mm-hmm.
and then letting that sit for a while, because that lets the gluten form and get strong, and the gluten is the sort of the sticky, stretchy part of the dough. And if you can imagine putting that dough under a stream of water, then the starch washes out and you're left with the gluten. And with the starch, there's two grades of starch that are based on their molecular size. So there's clean white starch, and then there's sort of the junkier stuff, and a bunch of other wonderful things that are in flour. And the process refined each stream to its best point, and then generally dried those products. Mm-hmm. So gluten, I think, you know, there's a sort of a gluten-free craze now,
but
gluten is really a truly wonderful thing. If you imagine a hamburger bun, a good one versus a not so good one.
Not a McDonald's bun, but say an A&W one.
Well, it's the strength of the hinge. Mm-hmm. The strength of the hinge is the gluten.
I see.
And in a lot of commercial bakeries, big ones, using gluten allows the company or the bakers to determine their best use of flour plus gluten to get what they want in the end, because you can beef up the quality of your flour with gluten.
Yeah.
Shaw's used to buy gluten from us. Mm-hmm. Not much, but they used to buy some. And the other thing that where gluten comes in particularly handy is for making breads with a lot of whole grains, and because you need that strength in order to let that loaf rise, so that it captures the carbon dioxide from when the yeast is fermenting.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a lot of gluten, it just kind of gets lost, and you have this sort of very heavy loaf of bread, as opposed to being sort of light and airy and elastic and moist and, you know, all those good things. So most of our gluten went into baking applications, you know.
Yes.
And then it also was used, we sent gluten all over the world, and we used to send it to Southeast Asia as shrimp feed.
So okay.
And, you know,
these were in shrimp farming operations.
Exactly. So, you know, the shrimp that you eat now,
yes,
that comes from Southeast Asia or whatever, it's probably been fed with gluten from somewhere. And it used to, a lot of that gluten used to be from Thunder Bay.
I see.
And
the starch would have domestic uses and industrial
uses.
The
starch was amazing, actually. The uses, we made a whole range of food and industrial starches and modified starches, pre-gelatinized starches. The wheat starch is whiter than corn starch, and it has less fat. And it used to be used in angel food cake mixes, but since this whole business with the gluten phobia, you see corn starch now. And North America is basically a corn economy, not a wheat economy.
And the U.S., all that maize growing down there.
And we also used to, was used in angel food mixes. And we also used to make a low dusting starch to put in icing sugar, because if you look at a bag of icing sugar, there will be starch in there, and that's to keep it from getting hard and to keep it flowing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big part of our business. That was one of our big products. We sold our starch in Southeast Asia for laundry starch.
Okay. This was the industrial starch, or was it actually the
that
domestic?
One was industrial, but it had basically the same qualities as the food starch. And then we made pre-gelatinized starches, where you take the starch, and there's a big steel drum that has steam in it, and you spread a very thin layer of starch on the drum. And it
on the outside of the drum.
Yep, and then you sort of peel that off, and you end up with this pre-gelatinized starch that was used in puddings, and we made one for LePage's wallpaper paste powder. Yep.
Yeah, yes, I was thinking that
was
some of the starch would end up in glues of one sort or other,
and
adhesives.
And then we made a whole range of modified starches for use in the gypsum wallboard.
Mm-hmm.
There's starch.
Drywall.
Yeah, there's starch in the wallboard, and it's part of, a matrix that forms with the gypsum and all the other good things that they put in there. and the starch is part of that so that it does that nicely. And we used to make the sort of the paste that they used on the edge, so that the little paper edge that you have.
Yes.
And we made a lot of starches for liner board. I don't know if you know what liner board is, but...
Cardboard?
Yes. Yeah. And...
stuff that they used to make out at Red Rock.
Yep. And we made this other blended product that was used for the glue on the bottom of paper bags.
Mm-hmm.
At the reed paper in Dryden. So our stuff was everywhere. Sweet. And people didn't, most people that I talk to, you know, people ask you, well, what do you do?
Yes.
That I tell them, and, you know, really, this happens in Thunder Bay? Yeah, it happens in Thunder Bay. Not anymore, but it did then. Yeah.
Canada starch, am I right?
That's a corn starch.
Oh, that's a corn starch.
That's a corn starch, right.
Despite the name or the Canada on it, but of course Canada grows
corn. Yeah, we grow
too.
A lot of corn too. So yes. No, they that's corn starch.
Was Ogilvy selling kitchen starch, if you will, under its own name?
No. All our starch was pretty much wholesale, and you know someone else did something with it.
Yes.
And
it would be a question later on, although I might ask it here. Do you think that? There was a failure to brand the product, to develop any kind of goodwill, as the marketing people would probably put it.
Well, you know,
for
I'm not,
the product.
I'm not so sure. I think that producing the starch on an industrial scale and then selling it, because most of the uses really were industrial for big.
Yes, I
you
can
know,
understand.
No housewife was going to go out and buy herself some wheat starch and buy some corn starch. You know, and I think Ogilvy saved all their marketing and branding for their flour, which was mm-hmm. Five Roses.
Mm-hmm.
And they Ogilvy bought that. Let's see, when did I? The Lake of the Woods Milling Company in Keewatin, they were milling flour in 1888.
Yes, they started at that time. I've written a paper on that, as it happens.
And then in 1903, that was bought. They were bought by Ogilvy. Well, and yeah, they were bought by Ogilvy in 1954.
Right.
And then that's when they bought that Five Roses name.
The brand name.
Yeah, and if you, in Montreal, the Five Roses sign on the top of the flour mill. Well, I think they've taken it down now because they sold the brand, ADM sold the brand name to Smucker's. So, because I don't think ADM doesn't really need a brand name. They're not into that stuff.
Yeah.
They're way, way bigger than that. Not interested in that.
Right.
So they sold the brand, which had, you know, has had a presence in Canada for a really long time.
Yes,
and,
in the late 19th century.
Yeah, so as far as the branding and all that sort of stuff goes, you know, I don't think I don't think that strategy was, you know, would have made much of a difference. What would have made a difference, I think, was if the owners, whoever the owners were, whether it was Ogilvy, Labatt's, whatever, whether instead of just taking all the cash, then that they, you know, for reinvesting, so that the plant could compete. Because in the end, we were too small to compete, really. And, you know, even though we'd had a new process installed not too long before the plant closed, I think it was too late for those things. The building hadn't been kept really, it was just a sad story all the way around that. I'm not sure any amount of money would have made a difference there.
What more of the failures of Canadian capitalism? In a
well,
sense,
I think so because it.
Or Canadian capitalists, more precisely.
Well, you know, instead of doing more of the final processing here, and instead of sending it off someplace else, and becoming self-sufficient in those things. You know, it's just one more sad story in a whole bunch of them.
Which there are too many such stories. Did you have a sense of a... Well, you were selling into a global market, when you talk about Southeast Asia markets, that's a certain amount of transportation cost involved in
Those
that.
things were were
Sent by
organized
rail to the way?
were organized by the head office in Montreal.
Yes, of
So
course.
they would organize all the financing and the because a lot of this stuff was done with letters of credit
Sure.
and that sort of
Yes.
stuff. And they would take care of the transportation, and that was another huge disadvantage for us because we could not in Thunder Bay load a container.
They hadn't equipped you to do that.
Well, it's hard to load a container in Thunder Bay. I'm not sure you can still do it, where you can. We could unload containers,
Yes.
but to load them up and send them off, that wasn't something that was that
This is a
would.
matter of what, getting them onto the rail cars?
Yes,
I
yeah,
see.
the logistics of it, of actually loading something and sending it. We when we when
These are
we.
the great overhead arrangements, the cranes and so on, where the containers are brought in by truck, perhaps, and then lifted over and dropped and so on. And there's nothing of that sort in Thunder Bay.
No,
I suppose you're right.
no, there isn't. And so what happened was that even our stuff, and here we are in the center of Canada, the
Yes.
stuff is going to Southeast Asia. It went to Montreal to get loaded into a container.
By ship, I suppose.
It got yes, and then it got sent by ship. So if you could load a container and get it onto a train here and then send it, that there was no way to do that.
And Kiefer terminals never built a
No, well, they had no reason.
container.
Who else was actually doing that kind of stuff? It's not as though there was a lot of other manufacturing here where you're gonna throw big boxes of crackers or whatever else you're gonna
Yes.
throw. So
Well, there's newsprint, but it was moving south, wasn't it? And our rail connections from
yeah,
Thunder
so
Bay
that's
south are quite poor.
well, they're not bad, but it wasn't the logistics were not in our favor, certainly. And even some of the stuff that went to Mexico, we could send that by truck. But anything that ended up having to go into a ship's hold ended up going to Montreal, which,
For
if there
Southeast
if there
Asia.
were if there were more manufacturing here and more of that sort of thing happening, well then, we could have done that here. But there wasn't. And that was really tough for us because it added so much cost to the product that, in the end we couldn't compete with any of our sister plants.
I don't think in this interview we'll pursue the issues, explore the issues involved in Thunder Bay's industrialization as far as it went, and then I suppose the decline of Thunder Bay as a manufacturing center. But there are locational advantages in the country, for the country to some extent, but there are also disadvantages, aren't there? Did you have a sense of a continental starch industry competition within Continental, or did
Oh
was the
sure, there.
Ameri
Oh sure, there was competition, but I don't know too much of the details
No.
about that because there isn't very much wheat starch produced in North America.
No.
There's some,
In
but
the
there.
US is very largely corn starch, as you would
Yes, but
say.
there are wheat, gluten, and starch processors in the States, so it was very competitive. And for some things, wheat starch was just better. So there were the competition for that was pretty fierce. And
Did you have a sense of the superiority of Canadian wheat in this production?
well, the sense that I got, and I wasn't too involved with the flour side of it, was that I was told by the quality people on the flour side that Canadian flour was top notch.
Yes.
The quality of the wheat, but then the quality of the wheat with the Canadian Grain Commission and the Canada Wheat Board, and how that was controlled. There used to be, well, Ogilvy had a bake lab in Montreal where they would, because the company did Ogilvy did a lot of grain exports. And where they would do milling and on a small scale and then set up for shipments for export through the Canada Wheat Board, and however that was done. I'm not sure how it was all done.
Yeah.
But in Canada, you could go into a grocery store and you could buy a bag of all-purpose flour. And, you know, there was Robin Hood or Five Roses, maybe Monarch. And those were going to be the same. You could count on that bag of flour, and it was going to be the same.
You mean the quality inside?
Yeah, the quality was the same.
They didn't come out of the same and the mills. You're not saying that.
The baking quality was going to be the same.
Yes.
And then there were, you know, sort of the next level, you know, pool flour, you know, whatever. Whatever those levels were. And the way it was explained to me was that that isn't how it worked in the States.
Mm-hmm.
That you did choose a brand, you know,
in terms of quality.
Yeah, yeah. And
that will probably begin to happen in Canada now.
And so in that sense, you know, Canadian wheat is, it's known to be superior. It's all
It is. It's had a long run, but what will happen now in the dramatic changes that have happened in the movement of grain, the purchase from the farmers and so on and so forth, the exports.
With the Canada Wheat Board and stuff, I checked out the web page for the Canadian Grain Commission, and they still report on wheat quality overall, and there's third party testers now, you know, and so I'm not sure how we've got a legacy of, you know, the grain inspectors and that whole process where people know how it was. I don't know how that's going to be in the future.
We need to interview my son as it happens. Our son has moved back from Winnipeg, away for 25 years. He was, I think, in the pioneering endeavors to third-party testing. I think a company out of Switzerland was involved, which had a global business in testing. He was sent out to Farz. We should interview him before we wrap this up.
There's an outfit in town, Intertech, I think, that does the grain testing. A friend of mine, once she lost her job with the Grain Commission, she's now working for Cargill, and she is, you know, training, you know, another couple, you know, some inspectors and whatnot. But she says, you know, it takes 10 years before you've seen everything and you know.
Yes.
You know what you're doing, and she's been doing it all her life. So I don't know how those skills are going to get moved forward if there isn't some sort of stricter quality control on how that happens.
I think the new government faces a lot of challenges, and one of them is surely the question of whether to endeavor to reestablish the Grain Commission, whether to ensure the Wheat Board remains, let's say, in the control of Canadian farmers, as it could conceivably. It's going to be a tough game.
I haven't kept up with how that whole battle is moving along, and whether farmers are better off or worse off. I'm thinking
the National Farmers Union says they're not. I belong to the Farmers Union for sentimental reasons and get their newsletters.
Well, I can quite believe it, and you know, and the thing about it was a cooperative system in a lot of ways, and as a whole, everybody was ahead.
About 80 years of that in Saskatchewan, the pools from the 20s and so
on.
It's a sad decline.
After the, and certainly after the, when the Crow's Nest Pass agreement was done, that also made our flour more expensive, our raw material, because we didn't.
When the agreement was done away with in the 80s.
Yes.
Western Grain Transportation Act kicked in.
Yeah. And then, yeah, so that made our raw material more expensive a little bit. And so that just added to.
Right.
But, it also made it more expensive for our sister plant. But for us, every added cost. And the plant also had effluent issues, you know, pollution control issues that were challenging as well. And there was some investigation into building an ethanol plant. And at the time, there weren't enough subsidies from the government for gasohol, basically, to make it worth it.
Yeah.
And so
Maybe just as well,
It
considering
is, you know,
everything that's happened since then.
yeah, it's there's something unsavory about burning food.
That's, there certainly is. Could you maybe walk us through the plant, sort of virtually, if you will? Would that be possible?
Sure.
Because we're talking about very interesting topics, but someone may wonder now, how exactly was this, how did things work in there? What were the stages of production?
Well,
a train would roll in with the flour would come in bags or in bulk?
Oh, in bulk, in those big tanker cars.
In the tanker cars.
Yeah, and if you drive past the plant now, you can still see the silos for the flour because they didn't burn because there was a fire at the plant
mm-hmm.
site
yes.
in 2001, I think. 2001, mm-hmm. 2002, yes. I can't remember. And the flour would come in and get unloaded. And then it would get
sucked up through the silos, or
it would get sucked into the silos, yeah. And then the flour would then get conveyed over to the plant. So the dry stuff was separate. So if you think of the flour coming into the plant into sort of a what they would call a day bin, whatever you were going to use that day, the flour would get fed into a big mixer. With water at a certain temperature, warm water, can't remember the temperature, and some salt, and make a dough. And so this thing was just pumping out dough. And then the dough would go into a huge hopper where it would have a little bit of a resting period before it went into the rest of the process. And at that point, the gluten is fairly well formed. It's there. It's very it's strong.
These balls are
huge
balls, I gather. You were visualizing it originally, a small one on the table, but these were huge.
Huge. And so then it would go into the next stage where you would sort of separate the most of the gluten from the starches.
Mentioning that part of the process.
So then the gluten would get rinsed and coddled until it was very strong, and this stuff was like elastic practically. You could, the quality of it.
I mean, that's in the grain seed, the wheat seeds in the
right.
flour,
and then
the stuff of that.
Yeah, and then it would get dried in a specific kind of dryer that wouldn't destroy the quality of it,
mm-hmm.
because if it was overheated. Then it would lose its quality, and people and our customers were buying it for the quality of it.
Yes,
you could pour some gluten into a cup, add some water, just take a swizzle stick and you'd have a ball.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. Okay. And
what was the source of the heat? In this
gas furnaces,
natural gas.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that would have been when natural gas came through in the late 50s. That would have made possible an upgrade of the process. Then,
I'm not sure how they did it before that, honestly. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what they used before that.
This process had begun in 43, I guess, the year
yes.
we're suggesting.
Yep.
Right? A question?
You got the gluten in a big ball, you wash it, or your dough, you wash it off, you get your gluten, which you say is elastic, and then what's the next step after you dry it out?
And then
what for, does it come out as a brick or a...
Well, it gets dried and it gets ground.
Oh, ground, okay.
Sifted, and that's to...
Final product looks like...
Like a very, this color,
mm-hmm.
that color, powder.
Kind
fine,
of
a very fine color.
Somewhat yellowish, whitish, but
tan.
Yellow tint.
They call it tan, but it's that's very close to the color
okay.
right there.
And grinding can only take place with something. Well, you said dried, so it's
so
actually,
it was kind of crunchy, you know, these chunks
yeah.
or whatever as it was drying, and then it would get ground,
mm-hmm.
sifted, and any of the tailings, the stuff that would get reground and.
Mm.
And then it would get packaged in whatever package was required. We never shipped out gluten in bulk. I don't think we did. It was in bags of various sizes.
Okay, so that's the gluten stream then.
So then, and then the starches.
Yes.
Well, then there was a process to separate the high molecular weight starch, the nice clean white starch, A starch, from the secondary starch, which was B starch. So there was a process for doing that. And then once the A starch was separated, various things would happen to it. Some of it was sold as liquid. We sold starch to provincial papers.
Mm-hmm.
And
for making fine
and
paper.
Then later we used to take that liquid starch and we would modify it. We would oxidize it. And we sold that to provincial papers and to Dryden.
This would end up being coating on,
yep.
on the
sizing.
Papers.
Yeah.
Yeah, sizing. Yeah, sizing, that's right.
And so then the starch would get dried in a couple of different, the main dryer for the A starch was called a Procter & Schwartz apron dryer. And what would happen was this starch, which was about 40%, 40% solids. I'm going to have to cough.
Should have done wrong.
If you can imagine this slurry of starch, and it always had to be stirred because the starch was so heavy it would just fall.
Mm-hmm.
Inside.
So it's in water solution. Then,
yeah. Right? It would go on to a drum, this time not heated, but that had a fine fabric on it and with vacuum, and it would get filtered, and it would get filtered up, the liquid would get filtered out that way. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have these chunks of starch. Sometimes you'd dry the chunks just as they were. Other times those chunks would get extruded. The starch that was extruded was typically for low dusting applications like the laundry starch,
mm-hmm.
and the icing sugar starch. But the rest of the starch just went through that process and dried out. And then it would get ground. Most of our all the food starches were ground, so they were a very fine white powder, just like cornstarch. It would look like mm-hmm. cornstarch, but much whiter, and
or sort of like icing sugar, which
yes.
you're saying has a fair
yeah.
amount of
that's
starch.
That's what it would look like. Wouldn't feel quite the same,
mm-hmm,
and
because there's
the
sugar.
The drier the starch was, it was almost like water. If you spilt it, it would just be all
spread
over the place.
Out, right?